Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to the great actor Edward Fox. Edward, you've just been at the Purbeck Film Festival with your brother James and your wife Joanna David. Your acting genes go right back to your grandparents' generation. Do you think there is such a thing as an acting gene, and you've clearly got it?
Probably, yes, I think. Probably, but whether I've inherited the acting gene or not, it would come through my grandmother, who was in Herbert Beerbohm Tree's company, but I know not in any celebrated way, although her sister was also in Beerbohm Tree's company and was quite evidently a very, very good actress indeed. So there may be some familiar link, but it doesn't come directly through my grandmother at all, Hilda.
And your father was an agent, is that right?
He was, but he came back from a war like so many other soldiers, without a job, without any money, no prospects. But luckily for him, he found a job as being an agent, which he then had two boys, my brother and I, to educate and all of that. So he really had to take a job. I think he would have liked to have been, I'm pretty sure he would like to have been an actor well before the war, because he was very, very good looking. So all his, particularly the maternal side of his family, will have said, "Oh, Bob, you're so good looking, you must be an actor." And he probably could have been.
And in your upbringing, were you encouraged to be an actor? Were you surrounded by actors?
Surrounded by actors, but very much discouraged to be an actor. Robert Morley said to me, "Eddie, dear, you're not really meant to be an actor. You're an introvert by nature." He said, "Now, look, I'm an extrovert. That is what you need to be if you want to be an actor."
But at the same time, do you think it's something you can either do or you can't do? And clearly you can do it magnificently. Did you just find you could do it?
No, I don't think silly sort of, but I've never done it magnificently, and I don't ever think one will do it magnificently or could do it in a way, because it's such an untouchable thing, finally. But I think the funny thing is, if you want to be an actor, you have to think, I can't understand why the audience appears to be listening to me, but they obviously are. And I think if you feel that, you've got a chance. For me, it's that immutable law. An actor walks on the stage and you think, I'm interested in this, or you think, well, he can go off any time he likes, which is what I feel a lot of the time.
And you immediately, in the audience, suspend disbelief, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And it's something to do with being the thing itself, I think. I saw it notably in that wonderful actor, Wilfred Lawson, who was a great actor, and a great presence, but immediately you came, you just say something, anything, immediately.
And as well as having a gift for it, there are things you can learn. You spent a lot of the 60s doing rep, is
thank
that right?
God, thank
and
God.
And were there particular techniques you learnt doing that?
You learned how bad you were. In my case, I thought I used to come off every part thinking that was terrible, but I've learned something from it.
You would see a mistake you'd made and say, I won't do that next time?
Sort of. You just think, why was I so bad? Why? Mind you, most of the parts you were inappropriate for. You get cast for Trigorin in the Seagull, age 24. You're not really ready for it. You're not ready for it up here. Funny enough, a lot of becoming good as an actor happens up here, I think. Because you, if one goes to a Shakespeare play, you think so often now you don't understand what you're saying to a cast of actors. It's only until you come to understand what the line is saying, I think, which means you're much older.
And also, if you're in rep and acted in so many plays, you end up with a lot of English literature in your head, don't you?
Yes. It was wonderful hard work. You never stop working. You're playing at night and then rehearsing a play. It was the most wonderful way of finding out whether you were any good or not.
And you played Hamlet, I think, as a young man.
I did, yes.
And was that extremely difficult to get that right?
Not really. We spent 6 months rehearsing it. And I think you've got to spend 6 months rehearsing Hamlet if you're a young actor before even stepping onto the stage.
In order to understand what's going on behind the lines, do you mean?
Yes, and how terribly bad you were at yesterday's rehearsal. And that actually when you said how all occasions do inform against you, you weren't convincing anybody.
And you're such a genius, Shakespeare, you keep on spotting new things.
Yes. Even now, into my late age, he's like a great friend. You know, to a musician, it would be like living in the company still with the dead Mozart, still with us. Shakespeare's still with one. The minute you say he's not with me anymore, you're not an actor anymore.
And you will know the thing that people say, well, he must have been a Welshman because he got the Welsh so well. He must have been a Scots, but that's... He noticed everything.
He noticed everything. There's a wonderful book that John Julius Norwich's Father Duff wrote called Sergeant Shakespeare, which he wrote because he said his wife, Diana, didn't believe that Shakespeare was in the army. And Duff Cooper believed he probably spent a lot of his life in the army, in the foreign wars in Holland, in the Netherlands. And the theory being that as a boy, he will have been involved in sheep stealing and therefore would have been hanged if he'd been found, which he would have been. But that in some way, the Earl of Leicester or Leicester's entourage will have discovered this genius somehow and taken him away to be part of the army in the Netherlands. I think it's a fascinating idea.
And also because his battle scenes were so extremely good.
How did he know? The personality of soldiers. I mean, the Iago is for one. But how did he know about all these military things? He must have been part of an army, I think.
Yes. And Edward, you went on to have an extraordinary film career. Do you really think of yourself more as a stage actor?
Oh, yes. I mean, you can only supply anything useful to a film, I think. I mean, it's not true of everybody. Michael Caine and so many actors on films are just masters of what they do. But I still think, you look at somebody like Robert Donat on a film now, and he's supplying a great deal more in a short space of time than many actors who are just film actors.
What did you think you supplied to the wonderful Day of the Jackal, a terrific film? You're extremely understated in that. Was that your intention?
I think so.
Yes.
You dream up a part, really. If it's any good, you dream a part over many weeks and months. And finally, you hone in down the way to do it. It was easy to arrive at it, that in The Jackal, really, because there weren't any lines. Fred's way of managing was the lines just carried the plot forward. They didn't say anything about the man at all. So all you do as an audience is just imagine what he might be thinking, which is much more potent than anything else.
Did you talk to Freddie Forsyth about the part? Did you?
No. No, I knew Freddie, and I never talked to him about it. No, I don't need to talk to the author about a part. You're either going to be any good or not, really.
And it's something like the wonderful watermelon shooting scene, where there's obviously no words at all. But with something like that, you think about it a lot before, because if there are no words, every single gesture is saying something. The way you strap the rope around the tree is very good. But you think through every single little gesture before like that?
Certainly. In that instance, I was very lucky in meeting Alan Bedell, an actor, very, very great actor himself. He died a long time ago, but... Alan was a commando from the age of 19 in the Second World War, and he taught me many of these tricks. He taught me certainly that rope trick, zeroing a rifle with that bit of rope. So you just practice it forever and ever, but it's to Alan that I have to give my thanks, because he taught me the trick.
And it's an eternal question in films based on real life, with... Edward and Mrs. Simpson, did you study Edward VIII film of him, or how did you go about acting him?
Well, my back of my mind, front of my mind principle about it was I thought if this is going to cut ice, really, you've got to, as an audience, the audience has got to think, is this really happening, or is it just a show? Or is it actually happening now? That was what I thought, ideally, one had to try and find if the portrayal of the man was going to have any power out there to the watching audience. So I tried to do that. I somehow think if you're going to try to portray somebody who did live and whom some people will remember, even then, Diana Cooper, I met her coming down the corridor and I was dressed as Edward. She said, the king. Yes, okay, fine.
Good moment. Then you had a very good example of that in A Bridge Too Far. You wrote a wonderful article about it in The Oldie because you knew the character you played, Brian Horrocks, pretty well. Isn't that right?
I did. I knew him from the moment we met to when he died, yes, which was lucky me.
And how did you discuss the part? Did he, obviously seeing him, but he... told you about Arnhem and exactly what went on, did he?
He met me at Castle Carey station and drove me back. I saw this cloth cap eyes underneath it, and I thought, that's the general looking at me. And he will have worked out immediately whether this guy was going to be worth talking to or not. Anyway, we went back to his house. And he said, now, what I'll do is I'll talk to you before lunch, then we'll have lunch, then we'll sit down here and I'll talk to you more after lunch. He said, well, what would you like? Do you want to ask me questions or would you like me to talk? I said, I'd like you to talk, sir. And he just did.
And your brilliant briefing speech about punching a hole in the German line, that was taken from him. Were you allowed to insert... lines into the script?
No. That, fortunately, that was what Brian's address to a 30 Corps commanders was. One of the officers had been there, Irish Guards, much later. He said to me, you know, we were all dressed in corduroy trousers and just shirt sleeve shirts and a scarf. He said, we weren't in uniform like that. It was much more like a cocktail party, really.
And then, and so when you were playing him in the film, were you trying to imitate him, or do you add your own interpretation on top? You're very funny in that.
Well, it was his enthusiasm, really, that was the key to that. Because he knew all those officers. It was really like having a talk in the mess, only just much wider. He knew how difficult it was going to be, and I think even then knew that the odds against success were stacked heavily,
Because there were just too many German forces gathered at Arnhem.
No, they didn't know that, you see. No. They didn't know that. But there were strands that did know that, and that could have been listened to. And that if they hadn't gone ahead, all those 10,000 lives would have been saved. But thinking about it over many years, I think it was just that it was the army way. They were highly trained. They'd been kept in reserve in England. They were longing to get into battle. And this was the moment they said, right, we might end the war in 1944. We might get into Germany. Let's go. Typical British.
And too early in the end.
Just, in fact, bloody unfortunate, because the panzer divisions were re-equipping and they didn't know about the plateau, or only small elements will have known about. The Dutch resistance did say there are much more forces here. But Brown said to me, we didn't know whether we could trust the Dutch resistance.
And you also had on set, I believe, the heroic Colonel John Waddy, who was rather good advising Ryan O'Neill, wasn't he?
He was. He was. Do you want me to talk
yes,
that
yes,
way?
Please, yeah.
Well, Ryan, I don't know why he did. All he had to do was to join the Belgian Air Force, who had gone up in a plane, fell down, and about 30 feet off the ground, Ryan had to join them in his parachute. Dump on the ground, then he had to go bomb, bomb, get his parachute off. Very, very simple drill. Well, he didn't do this twice. So this is a lot of time wasted, and the Belgian Air Force going up and down again. Anyway, Dickie, I came over to John Waddy and said, John, can you go and sort this out? I saw John wander over, talk to Ryan O'Neill. He came back and I said, what did you say to him? He said, it didn't matter. But Ryan didn't do it again. I think he would have given big... Because John will have told him what to do, how to go bomb, bomb. So I think he would have given him a pretty good evil.
And in the end, the film... Wonderful film, but you would say it turned out to be more pro-American than pro-British, would you say?
Well, it accented the American involvement, yes, it did. But the American involvement was huge, of course. They were at Eindhoven and they were at Nijmegen with British forces, of course. But their losses were so enormous, too. That I think it would have been wrong, really, to side either way, yeah. Because the sacrifice by America and Britain was so enormous.
Yeah, and you did national service, and you were keen to actually go into the army as a career. Is that right?
Not really. No. My battalion went to Malaya, and I had no interest in jungle fighting at all.
Because?
I just thought Malaya was a bloody silly place to go to, and I wasn't interested in being shot in the back by about the rest of my platoon, who were completely ill-trained and would have fought off anything. I thought, I'm not going to last long in the jungle.
But you did like the army life. Lots of people who did national service didn't take to it. But
I did. I liked the army very, very much. I'd never wanted to be a regular soldier. But I loved the parade ground at Caterham and the shouting and screaming of warrant officers and the fierceness of them. They'll all be dead now, but many of them had fought the Second War.
Yes, of course they would have, yes.
And they were a wonderful breed of people, which has gone now. I loved the brigade squad and the basic training at Caterham with the Coldstream. I loved it.
And you think still has an effect, a lot of people say, in later life, having been in the army, has an effect on them in later life. You're immaculately dressed. I bet you're on time for everything. Do you think there is still a streak of you that is very strongly created by the army?
Lucky me, if it does exist, yes. Yeah. I would. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. We none of us wanted to do it. But as soon as you got inside that barracks at Caterham and somebody started shouting at you and you just didn't stop moving quickly for another 12 weeks, it was the best thing could have happened.
And obviously extremely useful for playing officers, which you did many times, yes.
Useful.
You're terrific as Dyer in Gandhi. How culpable do you think Dyer was? There's still a debate about that.
Well, I went into it as much as I could and met a Colonel Stead who'd been in India with... the Imperial War Museum put me on to him. They said, he's on his deathbed, but he'll see you. He wasn't on his deathbed at all, but he gave me an energy. He said, what used to happen was that with these monster meetings, they would assemble, and then the British would fire over their heads. They wouldn't actually kill. They wouldn't shoot at them. But that would disperse the meeting and they would go away and then they'd come back somewhere else. But he said Dyer realised that in the situation that he was in, this is very controversial, but I will stick to it, that there was only one way of attempting to stop open rebellion in the whole of the Punjab, open rebellion, which is murder, rape, arson. Bad as it can be, pretty much. And the British element was being threatened too. Concept that the only way it could have been stopped was to Dyer to do all the correct things militarily, all the announcements, everything done militarily, absolutely to the letter correctly. And then do what he said he was going to do, which was fire on the monster meeting.
He had said he was going to do that.
He said he was going to do that. Yeah. And they will have said that to the other meetings as well, but not fired on the meetings. They will have dispersed the meetings.
Yeah.
But in that situation, Kirsten said that was the only way he could behave. Now, this is much disputed.
Yes.
But I read a book about Dyer and I've thought about it ever since. And I thought, that is, I think, what a military commander whose family had been generationally in India for three or more generations before, and he'd served on the Northwest Frontier too. That is what a commander had to do at that moment in that circumstance. And of course, these very tough moments in history are reviled by people who wouldn't have been there if they'd been pushed to be there. They still have every kind of opinion about I know better.
Yes.
We're getting it today.
Yes.
Big time, all over in this country. But there were what then happened was that He did what he said. He fired on the monster meeting and 1,200 people died. But so the Jalian Wallabagh marketplace, which I went to, it was impossible for anybody to get out because the high walls and the well and people throwing themselves in the well. It was a terrible situation, absolutely terrible, but it stopped the open rebellion overnight.
And so the scene, which is very, very harrowing in Gandhi, it was pretty close to the truth as far as one can tell.
I think it was. There was the other element was that they weren't Gurkhas. They weren't frontline troops. They were cookhouse troops. He gathered whatever he could for this action. And they won't have been disciplined to stop firing when they... I mean, I'm out of my territory and knowledge.
Yes.
They won't have been top-trained soldiers who will have obeyed orders. And panic will have engendered panic.
Yes. And in that scene, did you discuss it with Richard Attenborough? Was it something you...
I didn't discuss it with Dickie. I just did the scene as written, as required for me to do. I later on, after it had come out, all I said to Dickie, and he didn't like it, I understand why, but I said, look, if the press do ask me what I think about this, if they do, I'm not going to say Dyer was a wicked man and he did all the wrong things, because I don't believe that. That was all I said to Dick, and of course he didn't really like that.
Right. And Edward, I asked you the other day whether you'd seen The Day of the Jackal, the new version. You said you don't possess a television, is that correct?
No, we don't have television.
Never have?
Not here, no.
And that does seem quite remarkable.
Used to say, you stupid old man, you must have a television. And now they're older, they say, isn't it a relief there's no television?
And that's because most of it doesn't appeal to you? Most of it's rubbish?
I think most of it, a vast majority of television isn't worth watching. It's a waste of people's attentive time, in my view. But that's only my view. But the sad thing to me seems to me, I knew the days of BBC One, just about BBC Two, and the emerging ITV. That was all. And BBC One then was tremendously good, and BBC Two became tremendously good too. And I thought, years ago, I thought, this is a goat that will eat all the blades of grass in the field and then say, well, where have the blades of grass gone? I think that's what television has done. Now, there are very extraordinary people who run television, who make programmes, who wake up thinking, how can I make another load of rubbish to show to the public? And they do. And they make money out of it. Unbelievable.
And so here we're talking in your lovely house in Dorset. You'd prefer to read rather than watch television.
Yes. I've never read enough. I'm ill-educated. All these wonderful
books. We're surrounded by books here,
are here. Not enough time to mess about with television.
And you wouldn't want to look back at your old performances?
No. No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. If that was then.
Do you ever happen to catch them and look back and say, oh, that was rather good, or not? No,
I don't want to see any of it, really. No. If people say, oh, I did like that, they sometimes will mean it and sometimes they don't, but they're nice enough to say.
Yes.
And I think, well, jolly dee. You know.
And your children, Freddie and Amelia, are terrific actors, but again, it's quite hard to see them for the lack of a television.
Yes, yes. Well, you make your money now on television. It's very well paid, a lot of it.
Yes.
And as is always the case, you know, you become out of work as an actor. There's nobody ever going to say, you need a bob or two, I'll give it to you. No, yes. You must think, I wonder how much money I've got in my back pocket.
And also, one of the good things about the proliferation of channels is some of them are very good. So your son is terrific in Slow Horses, but again, you haven't had the opportunity to see.
No, I haven't seen one foot of it. I'm quite glad. He tells me, I say, what have you been doing? What are you doing with mine? And he tells me, and I've gone fall asleep as I listen.
Very good point to stop. And thank you so much to Edward Fox for talking to Radio Oldie.
Thank you very much indeed. I enjoyed it. I knew I would.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.